Hey, Troy, what are you doing this weekend?
I'm going to grab a beer somewhere. What do you have in mind?
I heard about this awesome new bar downtown. It's called Rage. The waitresses have a contest to see who has the most piercing.
No, man, that's not really my scene.
Well, there's another bar close by called Spit Cup. Check it out. The bartenders wear chaps, and every hour they shoot a guy.
No, seriously, I just want a bar where I can sit down and watch the game.
Okay, I've got just the place. It's called Lilac. You sit on pillows, and you drink from eucalyptus leaves.
No, Ned, but I just want a place where I can get a cheap drink and watch the football game.
Okay, I got it. This place, it's got a TV. It's called 816.
Libidotosis.
Yep.
All their drinks come in NBA hats.
Man, I just want a place like Kelly's.
Oh, you mean Kelly's Westport Inn? No, they've got all the basketball and bowl games. They've even got a heated roof. The view is really nice, too, if you know what I'm saying. Why didn't you just say you wanted to go to Kelly's?
Kelly's Westport Inn, 500 Westport Road. Make it your place to go any time of the week. Tell them the Royal Man Report sent you.
A show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past.
It's a place where I met my wife and my three children were born. And to this day, I'm so proud to call KC home.
A show that looks at Kansas City baseball's present.
Alex with a basket catch. They're going to send the runner. His throw, a great one. Alex Gordon with a tremendous Gold Glove play.
And a show that looks at Kansas City baseball's future.
Kansas City baseball fans eat baseball.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
And welcome back into the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
What the hell was that?
That's the best you're going to get, Scoby. I was told I had to have bumper music, and then they said to get No Diggity, and I don't have No Diggity because I'm white. And so I have AO technology. That's the closest thing I had. So that's what you get. That's your bumper music.
The request was Pitch Perfect music, not No Diggity. Not
well, take that up
black.
With your...
They do No Diggity and Pitch Perfect.
Take that up with your agent, Michael Engel.
If I'm his agent, he got problems.
So we're joined on the call now by longtime friend of the program, Kevin Scobie. And he is indeed another dreamy pitcher. And hailing from his vast estate out in California. How you doing tonight, Kevin?
I'm doing all right.
So I guess the Royals have a little something going in their favor. They got this guy called Kyle Zimmer. Tell us a little bit about Kyle Zimmer and what you're seeing from him and if he could actually turn out to be a Royals starting pitcher.
Well, a couple years ago, I guess when he got drafted, when I was still doing stuff with Bullpen Banter, we did a little bit of a piece on the top three or four pitchers that were drafted. The college guys are kind of the focus between Mark Appel and Zimmer. And who was the other guy? I know Freed was the high school kid out of Harvard Westlake in the California area, but
Gausman.
Yeah, Gausman was the other one. And so out of those three, Appel, Zimmer, and Gausman, just kind of watching through their videos and then talking with Kyle Bodie, who does driveline baseball out of the Seattle area, we kind of were just all over Zimmer. I mean, that was the guy that stood out the most in all the videos we saw. And Appel, for whatever reason, I don't know if it's because he went to Stanford or because he's just been more of a commodity for a longer time, gets a lot of the attention. And he was the consistent number one pick last year and again this year. So for whatever reason it would be, the production of a higher level is probably what it would be just because he was a Pac-10 pitcher and coming out of the University of San Francisco, Zimmer didn't face probably the quality of competition. So that may have knocked him down a couple of notches, but just everything video-wise, the athleticism, the way the arm works, the way the trunk rotation works. The thing that impressed me the most about Zimmer is 2 years ago when he was drafted in the videos that we were looking at him, he had a issue with his front leg that he would block it out. I don't know if I can explain it kind of clearly now, but as you get through your mechanics and you get the foot strike and as you go to rotate through, the front leg will straighten and it's part of a deceleration mechanism that allows your body to kind of circle around and slow down. Well, what he would do is he would block himself in to where the rotation would almost stop, and he wouldn't be able to finish through himself, which is kind of a problem that a lot of guys will have every once in a while as they come from the field to the mound. And looking in videos that I've seen kind of here recently, whenever Zimmer was in Wilmington, he seems to kind of correct that a little bit. And so for that, it's one, it's a good sign that there is some sort of development going on with him in the Royals minor leagues, which I know probably everybody's going to have their opinion of the Royals developmental system. But at least they did recognize the problem, and it has been corrected to an extent. Now, I don't necessarily like the way it got corrected, too. They could have made it a little more efficient. But there is an injury concern whenever guys do block themselves off like that. And because that's been ironed out, that sort of injury concern really isn't there anymore. It's just it could have been – it's the way it is now is fine. It's not ideal. But at least it has been corrected to a certain extent.
And one of the things that you and I have talked about before is – kind of the ideal way for a guy to throw, and you know what you've told me, and I'm paraphrasing, but it's basically like you don't want to change your throw too much from what you would do. You know, if you're a shortstop and you can throw, you're just going to throw it. You're going to throw it well, and you know, a pitcher doesn't need to change too much if they're throwing well. Is that accurate to kind of what your observations have been through, you know, your own experience and in coaching, pitching, and in training?
Yeah, I think the first thing that I noticed whenever first saw Zimmer's name kind of come across, and he was rumored originally with the Royals there, number 7 pick or whatever it was that he was a former shortstop or a former infielder. And because of that, you sort of eliminate the chances there are going to be some bad habits created through high school and college of coaches trying to make you look like a normal pitcher or what they view as a normal pitcher. And so I was kind of interested from that and kind of perked my interest. And I guess, really, if you kind of explain it without having sort of a video demonstration, after a shortstop fields the ball and he goes and make his step towards first, as his hands break and he goes to stride, at that point, there really is no difference between a shortstop throwing and a pitcher throwing, except that a pitcher has a leg kick. But once you get to that point, everything else is the same. And so that's what pretty much you see in all the videos of him is it's a natural movement. And with his crazy, crazy quick arm action, the athleticism fixes itself with all the sort of you usually have issues with sort of a hip rotation or any kind of balance issues or any kind of postural problems where the guy will almost collapse his top half too soon or it'll hold back the top half. Zimmer doesn't have any of that. His posture is almost perfect. The way he does get through, the hip slide into and out of leg kick, it is the perfect scenario where you don't have a pitcher who has been taught all of the normal bias against pitchers that have trained them all the bad habits, and you've been given a fresh athlete, and you can say, go throw a baseball. And I guess that is the best-case scenario when you have a 21-year-old that hasn't had to go through all the bad teaching.
It's almost like it's too good to be true in the Royals. He'll succeed despite the Royals' best efforts in this case.
I would think so. I mean, he's probably got a ceiling of a 1, and then if with the Royals and the way they've gone with it so far, he should be no worse than a 3, I would think. But and it's almost – it's kind of crazy that the Royals did even take Zimmer because he's almost nothing at all of what they would view. I mean, he doesn't fit anything they've done in the past. Pochaver was an athletic thrower who they turned into a cookie cutter guy, but he always had this little bit of warning signs that he could be that. Mike Montgomery was drafted with the second round pick, and he was more of a training tool of like the Ron Wolfer system, and they took that away from him and put him into a box. And I'm surprised they haven't done that with Zimmer so far, but they haven't, and it's nice that there is that sort of evolution. I mean, it's 8 years into it. You expect at some point there would be an evolution.
A little late, but
it's nice to see. And all the videos now are pretty impressive that I've seen of them.
Now, one of the adjustments that he was talking about, and you know, you always hear about adjustments that pitchers make, but one of the ones that he was talking to Pete Grathoff of the Star was going out of the stretch and changing from having his hands high to putting his hands down towards his waist as one of the things that he credits towards his most recent run. You know, his last 5 starts, you know, he's thrown 31 innings. He's been nearly unhittable. He's struck out 30 guys in the last 3 starts, including 7 in Double-A in his Double-A debut. But how much does an adjustment like that actually help, and what kind of adjustments would you say that a pitcher needs to be making? Is it so much on that setup part, or is it like you were saying before on, you know, where they're finishing when they're planting their foot and where they're, you know, following through on everything?
Ooh, that's kind of a loaded question.
that's why I asked.
for Zimmer himself, I think the hand positioning is more of a cosmetic thing than any kind of functionality. I don't think it has really much to do with anything performance-wise.
Like if he thinks it works, it kind of works, and
yeah,
that's kind of where you go with it.
Systems of that we call it a teach is a way if you've use a phrase that may not actually, taken literally, may not be what you want it to be, but it gets the point across. And so by having him sit with his hands lower, it may allow him to either kind of clear the front side a little quicker or gets into his arm swing a little better and a little more freely that way. I was always a guy that set high, and I always taught, I like to teach my pitchers to set high, but it really kind of depends on the guy and what he's used to. Mm-hmm. If his normal windup is with his hands low, which it is, he does have his hands low, I would think that at some point that would need to translate into your stretch positioning to where there's not much of a variance between what you're doing windup, what you're doing stretch. And so I would think probably that would be the only reason why, is that if he is effective out of the windup and he is so free and easy out of the windup, and you've worked with him to fix the front leg blockage, you don't want to create any other variables to that or throw anything else in there where his body has to relearn or readjust with a different setup. So let's try and mirror the stretch as well as we can to the windup.
Let me reset this. I didn't mention when we brought him on, Kevin, the reason we're having him on is, other than being a friend of the program, he's actually a former pitcher that had enough talent to possibly make it in the indie leagues and do something a little bit more than that. But he has taught pitching for many years too, so he understands what he's seeing a little bit better than somebody like myself or Mike do. So that's why we're having him on to talk about pitcher specifically. All of a sudden, in the last couple of jumping off of Zimmer and onto some of the others that are in the Royals organization, in the last couple of months, we've seen Northwest Arkansas kind of be a hotbed of pitchers that are making you go, you know. Up until the 22nd, Jason Adam had looked pretty good. He started off real well and then through three innings looked good, gave up three runs in the fourth, and then got plastered in the fifth. You know, it seems like he really had it together this year, and he's looking really good. Jason Adam, of course, probably the favorite of this show. What can we expect out of him? What is his floor and ceiling, and does he have a legitimate chance of being part of the Royals rotation in 2 years?
Everything that I remember from him from before is that he's kind of the same similar type package of Zimmer, just maybe not the peak velocity, but a good athlete, but a strong-looking kid. I think he's the one at Overland Park, right, with the Blue Valley?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so it's and being 21 and in Double A already, there's some reason to believe that he is on a little bit of a fast track. I wouldn't be too concerned about what his ERA is in the minor leagues. I know that there's been a lot of talk about that recently just because Wilmington is such a pitcher's park, and let's see how they do against getting the competition and Double A and all that. But I would worry more about sort of the strikeout they need to pitch, are they generating the swings and misses, and from everything that we've read and heard about him, and I think even didn't Jason Parks like him a lot last year and used to write about him a lot as well, that kind of thing.
Jason Parks has always liked him. Kevin was always down on him. So yeah, Jason's always been pretty positive on Adam, but then he was down on him for a little bit because Jason struggled last year for a while, and then the beginning of this year he seemed to really have it together. And so that's kind of why we've really kind of tuned back in on him. Obviously we tune in on him because he's a friend of the program.
He's been
too,
on the show 37 times.
So it's definitely something that is of a great interest to us. But I mean, it just, you look at the pitchers that are down in Northwest that have been pitchers that people have had their eyes on. Noel Arguez, I mean, is there any chance he ever makes it to the big leagues?
I would doubt it at this point. I think you've had this many years of sort of subpar performance or zero performance. It's hard to think that at any point he's going to have any sort of an impact. And that was really kind of a flyer to begin with, wasn't it? Just that was one of those, hey, this is a guy that has got a decent track record or a decent name, so let's try and throw a bunch of money out of it. And that also could have been more of a, if it's kind of a recruiting tool you use in college too, that if you get into a school that may have a guy in the 06 recruiting class that may not be as good as the guy in the 07, but if you get the guy in 06, you have a better chance of getting the guy in 07. So maybe one of those things where they may have overpaid for him and went after a guy they may not necessarily have wanted in an effort to kind of grease the skids a little bit for anybody down the road.
Yeah, look, we're going to sign these guys out of Cuba. Great.
And then a conversation that I don't know if we had, I don't know if we had it on the air or behind the scenes, but Brooks Pounders, friend of the program, Chris Kamler's favorite Royals baseball name. He is in Double A.
To be fair, Kamler doesn't even know what position he plays. He just likes the name.
Exactly.
Does Kamler know anything, though? Let's be honest.
No, it really doesn't. He knows pretzels and cheese, and that's about it.
Mostly cheese.
Mostly the cheese, yeah. You're right.
Anyways, Brooks has had a couple of nice starts in Double A, including a no-hitter. Is this a guy that has a chance to be something with the Royals? Essentially, he's what we got for Mike Aviles in the long run. Is he a guy that's actually going to produce at the major league level, or what we're seeing in Double A just kind of a flash in the pan thing, and they threw him in Double A because they needed to fill a starting spot, and so here you are. You know, you're not a big name to us, so we don't really care how things turn out. You know, you're not Kyle Zimmer, you're not the rest of this organization. You know, those kind of guys. But then Brooks shows up in Double A and he's doing well. How much of an opportunity does a guy like that have to make the big league?
I think as long as you can kind of keep improving on your strikeout to nine ratio, I think anybody has a chance to kind of do that thing. And I think when you flip somebody like Mike Aviles, you're kind of looking for a bullpen arm. And so at very least, you could think that any of these guys that can strike out batters is at the rate that even Pounders is. So this year he's at a 7.5, and it's a little bit down from the year before. But every year before now, it's gone up. And so if that continues to kind of progress, there's no reason to think that he couldn't at least be, a 6th to 7th inning guy, that kind of thing. And if that's the case, somebody that can control, that you have team control of for, 3 years at league minimum with 3 arbitration years, but you have 6 years of team control that can get you 40 innings a year out of the bullpen is a pretty valuable piece. And I think anything we talk about with either Pounders or Adams or anybody else in the system, that if you can just say, hey, if I can replace this guy with Hochevar or Chin and get the same production or maybe just a tad less, at the end of the day, we're ahead of the game because we're only paying these guys $500,000 for the first 3 years, which is the very reason why you don't resign Chin and the very reason why you don't resign Hochevar is because these kind of guys should always be available. Now, if he's only 22, he's probably still a year away at least, but his ERA numbers look good and he's got decent velocity. I think it's all you're kind of looking for out of the bullpen guys anyway. And as long as his strikeouts stay kind of one-to-one with his innings pitch, that seems like a prime candidate for a bullpen guy. And at that point, bullpen guys are so fungible anyway, where a guy 1 year can be a 6th-inning guy, and the next year they can be an 8th- or 9th-inning guy, just depending on how they progress out of the pen.
He's always been a guy that's been looked at as primarily a bullpen guy. I mean, this is the first year where a majority of I guess I got to take that back. Last year he did start more games than he relieved. As he came up, through the Gulf Coast League, he pitched 23 innings, started 4 of 9 games. In the New York Penn League, he started 4 of 16, only started 1 of 36 in the Sally League before being traded to Kansas City in 2012, and then he started 23 of 28 games. And then, of course, this year, 14 of 22. But it's interesting to see what they've done with him, because when they traded for him, we all believed that he was just going to be a bullpen arm, and now they seem to kind of have him as a starter. Is that just somewhere to use him for now, and then by the time he gets to AAA or the majors, you'd expect him to fall back into a bullpen-type position?
Probably, because you have to try and get guys used to the certain roles as they come up, and I guess ideally in the minors, it's kind of flipped from where you want a guy to progress once you're in the majors. Is the minors getting the most innings as possible, work on as most pitches as possible, and then once they're in the majors, kind of work them the other way and put them in the back of the bullpen, learn how to put hitters away, and then once they figure out how to put hitters away, then you can move them up to the rotation. My guess would be that anybody that they have that they kind of feel has a major league future would kind of take that route, and it would be a starter in the minors that you can kind of learn how to use 3 or 4 pitches and get batters out 2 or 3 times through just to get your innings in. And then once you hit the upper levels, then you work your way back to the bullpen and work your way back through that way. My guess would be, though, that if you already have Duffy, Paulino, Ventura, Zimmer, and unfortunately Davis and whatever you do with Mendoza. But you already have, what, 7 or 8 starters that could be in contention to start next year, and then maybe even the year after that if you want to include Guthrie in there. Good God, there's 3 years for Guthrie on that contract. But you have those 8 guys. At some point, you need to start putting guys into the bullpen role. That way they can get used to that. And I would imagine that would probably be what they would end up doing with the majority of these guys, maybe even Adams too, that once they hit AA, AAA, put them in a bullpen so they can be used to doing that, and then they can come up, and once Herrera and Crow and Holland start to become super expensive, push those guys out and run the next group in.
And, Kevin, I've got a more of a general question here, but you kind of talked earlier in reference to Mike Montgomery and how he was kind of more from that Ron Wolford school. And we had Alan Yeager on the show quite a while ago, and he's got, you know, similar methods to what Ron Wolford does at the, I believe it's the Texas Baseball Ranch, whatever they call it down there. But so I'm wondering, you talked about how Zimmer was basically the polar opposite almost of what the Royals typically look for in a pitcher. And if I remember correctly, I feel like I remember hearing that they actually had a deal worked out previously where he would get to kind of train how he wanted to, and the Royals wouldn't necessarily force as much change on him. I don't know exactly how that works out in contractual language, but I know there was some sort of agreement in place, I think. So my question is, though, if you're not Kyle Zimmer and you don't have the foresight to do something like that, which I think most 18-year-old kids don't, and they don't really know, so, and then you come to the Royals and you've been training one way, whatever it is that you're training, but then if the Royals might try and change, like you said with Hochever, he was a real athletic guy, then the Royals kind of try to change him into this cookie-cutter model. So if they bring that to different players, how does that affect a pitcher, especially if you're like a high school guy like Montgomery was or Duffy was, where you're just at that really young age and you've been training a certain way, and then all of a sudden the Royals try and kind of, or you know, any team or whatever, if they try and change what you've been doing, how does that affect you as a pitcher?
How much time you got, Jeff?
I meant to put the disclaimer up. We don't have to get too in depth here, but I mean, is that
bullet point?
When is that detrimental? When is it helpful? Like, where do you kind of draw that line? Almost.
It's tough to answer because I'm on one side of this. I guess kind of characterizing my sort of progression into this line of thinking. I was a natural athletic thrower in high school, had that taken away from me, and then from about 18 to 24, I was lost, and I never could find it again. And then 24 was when I found the Wolford system, and it all came back. By that time, it was too late, really. And so I can't say that as a kid, if you're drafted at 18 years old, we'll take Trevor Bauer, for instance. In a lot of ways, he's been the driving force between this whole revolution. A lot of the Wolford system has been driven by Bauer. It's Bauer's ideas. It's Bauer's research. It's all put into actions that way. When he's drafted because of what he does. That has made him the pitcher that he is. Montgomery went to high school with Bauer. He was drafted because of what he does, made him the pitcher that he is. And when you hit a system like the Royals or probably like the Diamondbacks as well, or anybody that is ingrained into the no long toss, the tall and fall, the get long at the backside, pitcher shouldn't lift, pitcher should always run distance, and all this line of thinking that has been categorically refuted by science over the past 10 years, you're screwed. You're an 18-year-old kid. What are you going to say? No. You don't have that choice. And it's always funny to me, and I've had this conversation a lot of times, where people give the idea that if a player fails, it's always on the player. If a player succeeds, it's because of player development in the system. And that's not fair to the athlete himself. I've always held the contention that we have never seen the best baseball player ever, because that player at some point in his career was coached out of it, was coached out of what he was doing. There is far more bad coaching than there is good coaching at every level. And it's always going to be that way because the science is always further ahead than the industry. And I've mentioned this a lot of times in things that I've written about how I've talked to scouts and they've always said, you can't change arm action. You can. I did it myself and I've trained kids that have done it. They've been told that they have to look for a certain thing, that they cannot afford to change their philosophies because that would mean their job. The industry is taught and is paid not to evolve. And as someone in the case of like Montgomery, you've been training a certain way for 4 years. You've been doing weighted ball programs. You've been doing a long toss program. Yeah, you've been basically following the World Force system, the Jaeger system, and you get into an organization that is paying you money. You have to do things their way, whether it's right or it's wrong. You have to do things their way. But from the organization's perspective, is they feel that they're right, so they don't really necessarily have any reason to conform to what the pitcher wants either, because they feel they're justified in what they're doing. It's a loaded question, I would think. From a pitcher's perspective, if you found something that you like and that works for you, above all else, that should kind of be the ending decision. But I've had more than enough kids come through that I've trained that have all said, hey, I like doing this, it feels good. And I go, hey, give me 4 weeks, and all of a sudden they're throwing 4 miles an hour harder. It's conversations that I've had with Kyle Bodie about this. It's hard to go, hey, my way is the right way. It's not necessarily the right way because we've chose to teach this stuff. It's the right way because it's based on science. It's based on fact. And to me, I would always gravitate towards that, but you can't make an industry change overnight. And as kind of bad as this may sound, you're also dealing with scouts and organizational coaches and guys that have been taught that graduated high school, that went to the minor leagues, that were taught from guys that graduated high school, that went to the minor leagues, that were taught from guys that graduated high school, went to the minor leagues. There's mm-hmm. There's no history of education in the industry at the lower levels, which that's where this kind of thing breeds. And it's sad, but it's as an 18-year-old, what are you going to do? That's just kind of the way it is.
Yeah, I never understood why a team would draft a guy in the first round or the second round and say, you know, essentially they're saying, whatever you've been doing has been great. We want to put this investment on you. Now let's change it all. I've never understood that when, you know, the Royals or any other team does that, and it always confuses me to see it happen. And, you know, it's exactly what you're saying. It's just this dogma that's always persisted throughout the industry and through baseball, and it's, you know, what your grandpa teaches you when you're doing this, it's like, you know, it lives on. And, you know, I think there is something to be said for the curiosity. I think, you know, if nothing else, it's interesting. And what's it going to hurt to try it if somebody's struggling and it's helped this guy? And I don't know why teams don't try that more often.
That's the main thing. If you guys ever read the story of Tyler Matzek, who got drafted by the Rockies in 09, 10, somewhere there. He was a high school kid out of kind of where I am out here, and I think he went to one of the Catholic schools in Orange County that are a little further south in here. But he was the top 10 pick, and he was left-handed, and he got drafted throwing like 95, 97, somewhere in there. And then after a year or two in the Rockies system, he was 88 to 90. Well, they completely changed the way he threw, and I remember reading this that he would beg, "Can I go back and train my old coach?" Well, at some point, when as an organization do you go, we drafted this guy at 95, all of a sudden now he's throwing 87, and we've changed everything about his training program. Maybe the problem is on us. But that's rarely how it goes. They're rarely that reflexive mm-hmm. of themselves, and it's always, well, what the player's lazy, or the player's not doing this right, or he needs to do this right. It's, well, no, the guy lost 7 miles an hour and he's doing everything you ask. At some point you need to go, what are we doing wrong? The same thing with Montgomery is that you drafted this guy at a certain velocity. He's now lost velocity. And instead of asking questions and going, well, what did you do before? And how do we adapt your program from before into what we're doing? You just push forward with your ideals. And it's reflective now in the way that Peyton Moore in this regime handles their major league roster. We have an offense that's terrible. We have an offense that's been terrible for 7 years. Well, let's just push forward. Let's go after Gorkas Ramirez or Hernandez. Let's give at bats to Chris Getz. Let's keep running Alcides Escobar out there. Let's keep giving Mike Moustakas at bats. Guys that just swing at everything. instead of going, what are we doing wrong that we cannot produce a position player that that is a four-win player? Because like my tweet earlier today, three seasons in the last 8 years, they've had a position player put up four wins or more. And two were Alex Gordon, and one was Mike Avilas. That's absurd that an organization go 8 years and only have that kind of production out of a position player. What are we doing wrong? Instead of saying, hey, what are we doing wrong and fixing that, let's just keep pushing forward. Our way is the right way, and we'll just if we just keep doing the our way of doing things may be wrong, but if we just do it the wrong way a little bit harder, then eventually it'll be right.
And if we wake up one day.
And we'll wake up and we'll be good.
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes back to the Royals would rather be right than good. And they're never right. They're just keep on being wrong, and that's why they continue to suck. And it's like it's exactly like you guys both said, it's crazy. At what point do you look at it and say, why am I keep banging my head against this wall? Why do I not realize that it hurts? Or I mean, it just, you, when do you change? And he hasn't. Dayton Moore hasn't. And your story brought me I talked to Chris Grueler once, who was a pick in 2002, and he had worked with Alan Yeager. Alan Yeager was actually the guy that got me to talk to him, and he went to got drafted by the Reds. I think he was a top 10 pick. I can't remember he might have been a top 5 pick, but he was a long toss guy, and they brought him in, and all the pitchers are training and they're going at 120 feet. And then Chris Grueler tries to go a little bit further, and the coaches just come in and shut it down immediately. And they're just like, no, we don't do that here. And he asked why. And they just said, oh, no, we don't do that here. And I asked him straight up. I was just like, well, you know, did you ever really question, besides, you know, just asking, oh, why not? Or, you know, did you really question or push? And he's like, no, I didn't. You know, I'm an 18-year-old kid, and they're these major league coaches, and they're telling me to do something. I think they know better. You know, and I think that's also why he mentioned Trevor Bauer, why he's been so controversial, and everyone talks about how he's got a bad attitude and stuff. And I think he might have a bad attitude, but it might be a little bit misconstrued too, because he actually questions what the coaches are saying versus just accept it as blind faith simply because they're major league coaches and they're supposed to know, because sometimes they don't.
Yeah, and the thing is, Bauer has a genius level IQ, and he's the one that's been doing the studies for this for the last 6 years. There's a chance that he knows more than the coaches know, and that's where he's going to run into problems, because the coach is going to say something, and Bauer's going to know the answer, and he's going to, and instead of just going, hey, you're right, coach, and then going off and doing it his way anyway, he's going to prove that he's right, which is what you want, but this industry is not. It's not a conformist like that. They don't go that way. It's you don't rock the boat. You do the way we do things.
Yeah. Kevin, we're getting ready to. I'm here.
Okay.
I mute it so that you don't hear me breathing while, and I sometimes forget to unmute it. So
That's hot.
I don't apparently have a genius IQ when it comes to working a microphone. So there you go. You know. I was going to weigh in on a couple of things, but I guess you had mentioned the Aseydis Escobar. They keep running him out there. Now, I want to jump in on that, because you and I had this conversation on Twitter, and if people don't follow you on Twitter, @Scobes15, you're missing out, because Kevin is a very brilliant baseball mind. He really understands the game in a way that I do not, and I would venture to say the way that the other two guys on the show don't. So that's why we like to have him on. But you had mentioned that, you know, they keep running Escobar out there. Don't we want them to keep running Escobar out there? He's shortstop Jesus. Why would we not want him out there?
I guess it depends on how good you think his defense is. And this is, it's bordering on the Tony Pena Jr. kind of thing, where it's his defense is talked about in just insane hyperbole, is that we ignore the fact that he's really only, what, a +3 defender, +4 defender. He was, I brought up right now, so he was 9.6 in 11, and then he was -13.5 in 12. So he's probably not either of those extremes. But something about user either loves him or hates him. So he's an average defender, maybe a tick above average defender. And this is the Chris Getz argument, is do you understand how good a defender has to be in order to make up for the amount of outs that he makes offensively?
Yeah.
And this is... this is the little things argument, where it's, well, he does all these little things and he can bunt and he moves runners over and all this stuff with Getz. Fine. If that's your argument, that's fine. Do you know how much of those things he has to do perfectly, 100% of the time, to make up for how many outs he makes offensively? And it's my problem with Escobar has always been, and I know you're going to hate me for this, Troy, because you hate Greinke so much, is that we traded a peak 9 war pitcher, 2 years control of a peak 9 war pitcher for a meh shortstop and a center fielder. That's all we got.
The thing is, he would have never been that. Greinke would have never been that in Kansas City.
Oh, stop it. He was that in Kansas City.
He won the Cy Young.
But, and then he quit. He quit on the team.
He did not quit on the team.
He was not coming back to that.
He regressed. Players regress. He had a career year. I mean, there's only one way to go, and that's down from that.
He would not be in Kansas City what he is in L.A. There's no way you'll convince me otherwise of that. He wasn't happy there, and it showed on the field. But, I mean, we can agree to disagree on that, because
that
doesn't really matter now.
Different show.
Well, and it doesn't matter now, because he would have been gone. He was taking the first train out of town. So, I mean, it is what it is. I mean, I guess then the question becomes, is trading what you did with Greinke worth getting a few more years out of Escobar and Kane like we have? But the team's still awful, so no, it really doesn't matter.
And I know where Kevin's going with the next part of this. Because you look at what Milwaukee got for him.
Yes.
You know, they got an all-star, and they got a guy who, you know, could be, if Helwig develops, he could be, you know, one of those guys who strikes out a batter for 9 innings as a starter. If nothing else, he's going to be, you know, a late-inning reliever who comes in and strikes everybody out, too.
And I agree with that. And Milwaukee ended up doing better than Kansas City did with
for
less
two
time.
Months.
Less on, yeah.
Yep.
And so that goes back to what we've talked about for weeks now. It's time for a change in Kansas City.
Yeah, I'm okay. I don't know. It's always kind of the worst thing in the world to kind of say this guy needs to lose his job, but I've really been saying on this on the podcast with you guys, and I've been writing it for years now, since what, 2009 really. It's there were warning signs before, the players that Dayton Moore went after, and there were things that he did just kind of went, are you really going to spend your time on this? And in a lot of ways, it kind of mirrored the Scott Pioli regime of, like, is this really what you're going to burn your calories on? Like, this little minutia thing, this is what you're going to worry about? You're really going to sign Jeff Francoeur to a two-year deal? You're really going to sign Bruce Chen to a two-year deal? All these warning signs were there. And just my whole thing is the Greinke deal from the start, it smacked of Barrett trading Beltran and going, I need these positions. And instead of worrying about getting the most peak player in return, they got guys to fill a position. And even the arguments that I still get now, and when I talk about the trade, is that, well, we got a starting shortstop and a starting center fielder. Well, great. We got an average shortstop at best, and we got an average center fielder at best. I want peak value. And you had a 2 years control for a top 10 pitcher. You need peak value in return. You need a star in return, and they don't have that guy, and they still don't have that guy on the roster. That was the prime opportunity to do that. And it's been 8 years, and you still haven't developed a star. I mean, that's a problem.
I think they had a lot more coming out of Jeremy Jeffers than they got to. I think they saw him as a longtime closer, and he just never he just regressed so bad, and it was gone.
The thing about pitching is, at some point, you got to throw strikes.
I mean, he can throw the ball hard, but he looked like you know, the first part of Major League when Charlie Sheen can't hit the strike zone at all.
Yep.
You know, Rick Vaughn's great, but if he's throwing at everybody's head, what good is he to your team?
Yeah, and so. It was a straight fastball, too, so that's pretty hittable. If it doesn't have any bit of movement on it, it's, you know, you get the timing down, and there you are.
One closing thought, and then we'll probably wrap this whole thing up, but I had lunch with Danny Duffy over the weekend, and Kevin Scobie, you got mentioned in the conversation.
What?
Because and I don't know if he, I don't know that he has this right, so I'm coming to you to see if you remember this conversation.
Okay.
But I think I remember.
The day that Duffy blew up online, and everybody went after Duffy, including Nick Wright, he had said that some, I can't remember exactly what he was talking about, but he had said that one of the guys that went after him or whatever was one of the Kevins. I said, oh, it has to be a Gee, and he goes, no, I think it was Scobie or something like that. I was like, Kevin Scobie? He wouldn't do that. And so I was curious if you remember. Did you come out on the backside of that argument, Kevin?
I don't think I attacked him for it. I mean, I think I probably just said that probably wasn't the best avenue for you to vent your frustrations. That was really it. I mean, I understood his point, but he also, he's too involved with social media, and it's only going to hurt him eventually. He's almost too nice of a guy. And yeah. When you're going to vent frustrations like that, it's always going to backfire. And just like from a PR perspective, I mean, coming from somebody now who like does most of the PR for a company, there's no good that's going to come of that. I'm actually writing about Duffy right now. He's probably my second favorite Royal, and I have so much high hopes for him that I'd just rather him just kind of fluff it off and say, that Brandon guy, he's an idiot, and be done with it. But to go after him that way wasn't the smartest PR move in the world.
Yeah, one of the things we've talked about is, you know, that involvement, and you know, he's so many people like him on Twitter, and for good reason. I mean, he's a fun guy to follow, but a lot of people are translating that ability on Twitter to connect with people to what he does on the field. And the reality is, you know, the guy won't be successful if he's walking four batters per nine innings and only striking out 7.5. If he can get the walks down, you know, he can be as exciting as he wants to on Twitter. If he's walking, you know, two batters per nine innings and striking out 8 or 9, yeah, use whatever hashtags you want and go crazy. But, you know, I think it is something that gets people's hopes up. And when he comes up, you know, they're going to be, the expectations are going to be inflated. And, you know, the backlash, if he struggles, could be pretty bad for him because he's built things up so much that, you know, people aren't really seeing the whole thing from a baseball side. They're seeing it from a guy that they like to talk to on Twitter.
And being in the public eye is not conducive to being – you don't get points for being a good person being in the public eye. And he's too much of a good person. And it's one of those – it's counterintuitive. You would think, well, that would cross all barriers, wouldn't it? If you're just a good person, that's the way it is. And the way things are in social media now, it's probably not going to turn out that way for him. And it does suck because it also speaks to a larger problem. But it's – from his perspective, he could just kind of keep it just as simple as possible, just kind of jokes here and there, pictures here and there, stay out of the back and forth completely. It's the best thing he could do.
And we talked briefly before you came on that I had lunch with him when I was down in Albuquerque this last week when the Storm Chasers were there, and that was, you were saying how he's a good guy and everything, and my family was just blown away by how nice of a guy he is, and we all want him to, you know, I cannot comment unbiasedly on Duffy because I have, you know, gained a bit of a friendship with him, and I realize that I know what I think his top level is going to be. I know that he thinks he's better than that, and I love that, and I hope that he figures it out. But in your opinion, with what you've seen from him in the minor leagues, is he close? Is he ready? If they decide that Wade Davis is done and it's Everett Tiefert or Danny Duffy coming up and they say that it's Duffy, is he ready to start in the major leagues again?
I'm actually writing about that right now. And it's the concerns that I have a year out of Tommy John aren't necessarily anything about an injury. It's what's his velocity at? And I have emails out to guys now that have seen him in the minor leagues. Is the thing that separated him from the pack last year, or in 12 when he first came up, or when he came up last year, was that his fastball velocity had jumped 3 miles an hour and his slider velocity had jumped 4 miles an hour, for whatever reason that is. And if he can pitch at 94, he's an ace. He's an ace to a number two with that kind of swing and miss stuff. And that's kind of my concern now, is that if, you know, in a way to control his walks per nine at the Royals have slowed him down a bit, and this is more of a pitching issue altogether, is that people think that if I take away 2 miles an hour of your velocity, all of a sudden your command's going to be better. And that's not how it works. That's not how athleticism works. So as long as they've allowed him to keep his velocity, to learn how to pitch at that velocity, sky's the limit. It's just, that's my only concern from there, is just if they've taken his velocity away or not.
Well, a couple of things from our off-the-record conversation that we had. He did say that his velocity is back and his control is back. So he believes that he's ready, which is good. Now, if he is or not, I'll be interested to read the article that you post, and from what people have seen that actually have watched him, I'm going to be very interested to read that, because he is a player that we have our eyes on because of social media. I mean, he has definitely become a Royal favorite because of social media, and I truly believe everything that he says he believes. Like, he is speaking from the heart, and that's, like you said, that's going to get him in trouble, but it's kind of refreshing in a way, too, to actually see him speak that way.
And I will say this, too. I wrote something about him last year. Did I write about in April last year? Keithman said something stupid last year about him, and I went off on it.
Go figure.
Yeah, no kidding. And I wrote a post about it, and somehow, some way, Duffy read it, and then he emailed me and basically said thank you, and we kind of had a back and forth. So I am a little bit biased to him as well, just because of that. And from the things that we had talked about, it's our past and different things, the reason why he left the game, are kind of similar. So I'm rooting for him as well. And so I guess maybe I'll give him a shout and be like, dude, I didn't mean anything negative towards you with the whole blow up thing. Maybe I'll send him a tweet or something like that saying, apologize for, like, no, I kind of feel bad. Thanks a lot, Troy.
Well, I really just think he confused you with somebody else. And there was so much of it that
there are
day.
A lot of Kevs.
I mean, and that day was kind of mind blowing to me, because the next morning I kind of let everybody have their moment and rip him. And I don't know if Brandon's a listener or not, and I like Brandon. I've met him in person. The dude is brilliant, but he always finds a negative in the positive. Like, he finds a negative in the negative. That's easy. But he always finds negative in the positive too. And the guy's got a lot of time on his hands. I don't know why. It's not my business. But he always has time to find these most, you know, odd stats that Mike, even, you know, a guy that's a stat crazy, would not, you know, necessarily find. And he's always got all this information, and I give Brandon credit for that. But I think somebody needed to say something, and I appreciate that Duffy said that. And that's what I said the next day, and I kind of went off the next day and continued the whole Duffy thing and got it all riled up again, and actually got a text message from Danny, you know, thanking me for having his back or whatever. And you know, that was kind of cool too, but that's not why I did it. I did it because, like we've talked about, he's a good guy, and I felt like he got a bad rap for making a comment against somebody when all these times everybody's so ready to jump on the wagon when he says something positive and he's leading the bus, but let him say something negative and it was the end of the world. So I think on that note, we're going to let everybody get to bed. It's 10:30 in the central time zones, and for Kevin and I, it's the night's just getting started, but he's got like a family and stuff, so
not yet. I got a week to go.
Oh, I thought you had your baby. I guess that's how far behind I am.
August 1st.
The royal baby.
The royal baby. The real one.
That's right.
The one that matters.
Alex Gordon for Scobie.
There's no chance Sarah lets you name him that. Not a chance in the world.
Oh, hell no. I couldn't even name it Alex or anything like that. It had to be something non-Royals related, she said.
That's probably for the best, actually.
That's stupid. Shut up, Michael.
We don't know when the next show is going to be. I'm going to try to put together a run of interviews between now and next week, and then things get real crazy for all of us. All three of us are going into moves, and anytime you move, you have to deal with internet setups and everything else. And since we're doing this from our homes, bear with us as we get through this. We're going to try really, really hard to get you a show next week. But as Mike and I and Jeff talked about before the show started, the worst case scenario is you wouldn't get a show until time around the 9th of August. I really would expect to have something in the middle, but expect a little bit of darkness on the podcast until we can get resettled in with me in Albuquerque and Mike and Jeff in their new places. This is going to be a hell of a time for the Kansas City Baseball Vault family. So send in those emails at kansascitybaseballvault@gmail.com. If you have something to add to what Kevin has said, or if you have questions for Kevin Scobie, send those in. We'll have Kevin back on to answer your questions, and he's always really good about coming on. God, Kevin, it's been, what, a year since we had you on last?
Yeah, jerks.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, he yelled at me about it. I felt bad.
He's been cheating on us with the inverted W and the Pintar Press podcast stuff.
Yeah.
So.
Well. Yeah, they want me on. I feel wanted.
I take offense to that, because I have tried to get you on a lot. We just have had a hell of a time trying to get times that work for everybody. So, on that note, Jeff Hurd, do you have anything else to close out with?
No, I think I've said my piece for the night.
You've been very angry, and it's been refreshing, because we feel like we have the old Jeff Herr back.
This is what I bring to the table.
Mike?
I want the Royals to win, but they're not going to this year.
It's so frustrating. All you guys picking better than 500. Kevin, what did you think they were going to be before the year started?
76 wins, I think I chose.
You're more negative than me. Thank God. I thought I was the most negative person in the Twitter sphere for wins. I picked
them right.
Yeah, I picked them at 81, and everybody else picked over 500 or at 500.
I had 84.
I didn't know what happened to this group.
Whoops.
Whoops indeed. Let's see what happens. Kevin, any closing thoughts from you?
I want the good Alex Gordon back.
Yeah,
he definitely comes and goes. He definitely comes and goes, that's for sure.
Yeah, he does.
I want LC Escobar to hit JJ Hardy, so you guys are awful.
Okay. We need to wrap this up.
I gotta go.
Here.
For Mike and Jeff and Kevin, I'm Troy. And tell me to speak again. Send those emails to KansasCityBaseballBall@gmail.com. Have a great night.
What you trying to be yourself for?
What happened here?
I don't know. That's funny.
That was supposed to be just a short show.
Oh, I knew this one wasn't going to be short.
Megan's not here. I told Sarah, I was like, just 15 minutes. I'm going to talk about Zimmer and then I'll make dinner. No.
Well,
are you in trouble because of me now?
Oh, she went to the other room like 20 minutes ago, so probably.
All right, well, I'll let you go. My fiance's out of town, so she's actually out of state. So
Party
I'm in
Troy's house.
Exactly. Come on over.
Batching it.
All right.
Bye, guys.